This is WABF, and it's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review Talk Show, hosted by Dr. Lou Campo Madosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, including the Shell gas stations on 98 in Daphne and the one in Malbus on 181 with a state-of-the-art car wash. And good morning, Dr. Lou.
Well, good morning to you, Laurie. How are you doing this morning?
Doing great, thank you.
Very good. Well, with all this good weather, one could expect maybe we could have some good news.
Wouldn't that
be
nice?
But au contraire, there's not too much good news. I mean, look at our buddy Biden, okay? He's falling in the polls. I wonder why that's the case. Could it be the lawlessness on the border, the absurdity of letting all of these people come in? Many of whom have COVID, none of whom have been, you know, tested for COVID, and they're just going to release them into the interior of the country. And guess what? I mean, what's going to end up happening is the continuation of this COVID fear mongering. And you know why they want to do that? In order to make sure that they can steal another election in 2022. Just say, hey, it's still a COVID problem. We have to do all these mail-in ballots. And wonder of wonders, it's going to just be a repeat of last time in 2020. So, you know, I mean, that's just part of what we're dealing with. The other thing that's going on that is really kind of interesting is, wow, there's inflation, meaning that everything that you buy is costing more money. And one of the key things that we really need to have is energy. And what are we doing about our energy sourcing? Well, they've cut back on all this oil production, the pipelines, not leasing more lands, you know, to oil drilling. And so now, Laurie, listen to this. Just last year, we were energy independent after Nixon tried to do this in 1973 after the oil embargo then. We were energy independent. We were the world's leader in energy production. And now Biden's having to go to the Saudis and to the Ruskies asking them to produce more oil. I mean, this is such BS. It's beyond belief. Okay. Notice I said BS.
Thank
I
you.
Want to say something worse, but I'm under control today. Okay. So here you have this production problem and everyone's wondering why gases are now over $3 here in Alabama, going higher in other places, okay? So you have that issue.
So what's the solution?
I'm hearing
cries for impeachment. Is that a realistic option?
No, it's absolutely unrealistic because, for one thing, impeachment starts with the House of Representatives. The House is controlled by the Democrats, so forget that.
The fox is watching the hen house.
Yeah, I mean, but the fact is that really, even if the Republicans control both houses, the only impeachable offense that I can argue right now is the absolute, moving in the direction of not following our immigration laws on the border. That is an impeachable offense. He's breaking the law on any number of fronts, whether it's just letting them come in no matter what, not prosecuting those who are in already, telling the ICE people, don't pick these people up, just let them stay. All of these things are in direct contradiction to congressional laws. So in theory, you could do that. You could, in theory, impeach him as they tried to impeach Trump over what? Remember that phone call that he had with the Ukrainian president?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy, Biden, has a phone call with the Afghani president, and guess what? He basically tells the guy, look, you've got to make it look like you're hanging in there. So if you have to cook the books a little bit, go ahead. In other words, lie about how good the situation is or not. You know, so that's the short answer to that. But I don't think impeachment's on the horizon. The other thing here is that the continuing issue pertaining to how Biden came out of Afghanistan. Now, you think about this, okay? The reality now is that terrorism has now just been given a major boost. And that here again, we get to, well, the generals in their testimony 2 weeks ago basically said, we said, keep 2,500 people there at least. Well, Biden didn't do that. And then he had the audacity to say to George Stephanopoulos, well, the generals never told me to leave anybody here. And then the generals are saying, well, gee, we did tell them 2,500. So the debacle that ensued, basically this argument that, you know, we're going to get out of Bagram Air Force Base and then go to Kabul and try to defend that, it was absurd. The reality is that the State Department's pushing to give up Bagram, all of this is part and parcel of the people that Biden has brought back into government, Wendy Sherman, Blinken, all of these people, Susan Rice. They didn't want anything to go on in Afghanistan, and what they got, what we got, is exactly what they wanted, and that's the debacle that's there. So, you know, when I say to you that we haven't had too much good news on the national front, that's where we are. One last point. Hey, all of you parents who have been out here protesting with us about Baldwin County and the face masks and all like that, Lori's looking askance. Yes, we have been doing that. And we've actually moved in the direction of getting, you know, the superintendent to say no more masking in class, but he's kept the buses. But the fact of the matter is that now Biden, through, you know, the Attorney General Garland, they're talking about putting the FBI into the local school boards in order to protect the teachers' unions, the school boards, and all these people who are left-wing ideologues from the parents who are outraged over critical race theory and things like that. So, folks down here, we are, in fact, you know, on the offensive against what's going on in Baldwin County schools. We're going to stay on the offensive. I'm hoping that we don't see anything as absurd as calling us domestic terrorists. We shall see, okay? But here's something on the good news front. I'm glad to welcome Senator Greg Albritton, who is the chair of the Senate, our state Senate Finance Committee. He's the guy with the money. Greg, welcome to you this morning.
Hey, thank you, Lou. How are you doing?
Actually, I mean, after I've just gone through my opening monologue here, I don't think the country's doing too well, but Alabama seems to be doing all right. And I do appreciate the fact that you're on here today. Really wanted to try to talk about a couple of things that you're heavily involved with. I know with the whole prison bill, which we've gone through. I'd like to talk a little bit about what's going on with the redistricting bill. And linked to that is the HB 31, which is a bill to make sure that our people are protected against employer mandates to get the vaccine to work. And then I do want to talk a little bit about our favorite topic, which is I-10, the I-10 project, and wrap it up with that. So let's just kind of draw on your experience with the prison bill. And I guess the easiest way to do this, Greg, is just give me your thoughts about the good points and the bad points on the bill, and we'll just go from there.
Well, you have an aggressive agenda this morning, my friend.
I know, and we've got 25 minutes, so don't filibuster
this time
me.
You'll give us, but we'll get as far as we can. Okay,
okay, that sounds good.
Prison bill. As you know, we passed that by a supermajority vote. Didn't need to be a supermajority vote, but it was. We got bipartisan support in the Senate. We did not get bipartisan support in the House, but we got it passed, what was it, 74 to 20-some-odd.
Yeah.
So it was overwhelming in the determination that this was needful for the state.
Right.
The other key factor is we did this in the shortest amount of time that is legally and feasibly be able to be done.
Right.
By having it done in 5 legislative days. Now, this was set up that way by the governor with a special session so that we could concentrate on that one singular important issue, dealing with $1 billion or so in total and dealing with thousands upon thousands of lives.
Right.
And as a matter of protecting the public. So all that, I think, are some of the good points about it. You want me to go into some of the history of where we are and how we got here?
No, I think everyone pretty understands that we haven't built a new prison in many moons, and you know there are issues associated with lack of good prisons. I mean, infrastructure, problems with the guards, and prisoner issues like that. But I think that you know the what
do you think your listeners are aware that five prisons have been closed? Some of them fully, some of them halfway, but we had five of them that were basically shut down. Were you aware of that?
Well, I knew that there was some shutting down, but I wasn't aware of the extent of it, so I guess I better let you talk about that to make sure that we're all on the same page here.
We're not aware of that, okay?
Right. I guess I'm most aware of prison crowding. I mean, I think there's more prisoners than there are beds, and that was an issue.
Well, that's one, yeah. But when we started shutting these places down and COVID hit at the same time, we were in a tight.
Right.
Therefore, we've got about 3,000 state inmates being held in county jails.
Right. I was aware of that.
And the county jails are being paid for that. So that we had a major issue that was boiling over if we did not take care of this. So that was another matter that hasn't gained a lot of press and explanation as to the urgency of this.
Right. The other urgent part of this, too, is that the feds were breathing down your neck, so you had to do something.
Well, that's been used, and I'm not trying to downplay that, but, you know, this isn't the first time we've been in a federal lawsuit with these matters, and it's not just a single lawsuit. And that threat has been there since, for years.
Right.
So the threat, you know, the old cry wolf, I'm not suggesting that, I'm suggesting that the urgency in that argument had basically declined.
Yeah.
All right, we had become accustomed to that.
Right.
There was not a major feeling that that was the strongest impetus to pass this along.
Okay.
It was there. It's real. But the point is that we had more prisoners that we needed to get in. We had no facilities. We had to get them into safe quarters. Those were the urgent issues.
Okay. I got that. So, you know, as far as it goes then with the issues and everything, the next question for you all to deal with then was, well, how are we going to pay for all this? And I think that the governor's plan originally was shot down for good reasons. So in your funding scheme then, can you kind of address the way that you all were able to fund it and comment on, you know, if there are any concerns you have with, you know, say bonding, going down the debt side, or were you just pretty much, you know, okay with that, given the fact that there's a problem, we need to do something about it?
Well, let me start by saying that when the governor plan was not able to get the funding,
mm-hmm.
That's what caused the rejection of that, if you will. The international nor national funding was able to be obtained. And in that plan, we were going to build two prisons, new prisons of 3,000 inmates each. And that was it. All right. It was going to be 30 years and it was going to be on a lease deal.
Right.
And not get funded.
Wasn't that the real stumbling block, though? No one really thought leasing this was a good idea. You didn't own anything after 30 years.
There were several difficulties, political, monetary, and otherwise.
Okay.
But we allowed it to go through. We investigated that for two and a half years, and it just could not come to fruition. Too complicated and such. I had one guy tell me that he was a contractor, but he said he's been building prisons for 45 years throughout the nation, and that this was the hardest, most difficult and plan to put together that he'd ever experienced.
Yeah.
So if that is correct, I think we pulled off a pretty good matter here. But anyway, what we did is we put together a plan that would build two larger prisons, 4,000 inmates each.
Right.
That would give us a total of 8,100% filled, would give us 8,000 beds.
Right.
But in addition to that, we also purchased the vacant Perry County facility.
Right.
That's been vacant for a number of years, just been sitting there. It's been maintained, mostly maintained, but it is not updated. So we were able to purchase that $65 million facility. We purchased it for $15 million. We're going to put $4 million in it to upgrade the electronics and such, and that will then immediately give us 750 additional beds. Now, they're not high security beds, but they are beds that we'd use for several different transients and other matters.
Right.
So it gives us some expansion room and ability to house folks.
Okay.
So from that effort, we're looking at, in short order, having more than 8,000, just under 9,000 replaced beds that's out there. These are not new beds. These are just replacing those that we have already lost or that will be taken down or refurbished at another point.
Okay. So let me just ask you, on in terms of the numbers, my understanding is that you had 18,000 prisoners that you were housing in various places, and that the governor's plan only allowed for 14,000. So assuming you're going to take all of these prisoners back from the county jails, are you going to have any kind of a problem with the total number that you're dealing with?
We don't think so.
Okay.
All right, because we may have to, even when we build these new prisons, we may be putting more than 8,000 in there. We may have to put 9,000 or 10,000 in there, okay?
Okay.
Depending on what's available and some other things, and also getting them out of the counties, too. I think as far as how many we've got, we're not looking at doing any expansion of beds. We're just trying to get the number of beds to match the number of people that we've got. It's close, much closer than what we have now.
Okay.
And better control conditions.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's certainly a critical part to this. You know, I'd like to ask about prison reform, but, I mean, I've got to be careful of my time. Only one element of prison reform was passed, and that really was trying to expand the ability of people who were incarcerated to have, if they're going to get early releases, with electronic devices to cover them and give them an opportunity to move back into the civilian world. Is that basically something that you supported? And I kind of think it makes sense to do it. I'm not asking you a gotcha question, but I just think that of all the reform aspects of it, that's the only one that I understand passed. Is that right?
That's the only one. First off, let me two or three questions there, so bear with me here for a second, okay? First off, we passed one reformation bill in the special session. That reformation bill dealt with a limited scope of individuals, meaning that this applies to only those who are approaching their end of sentence, meaning that they committed a crime. They were sentenced to 25 years.
Right.
And they have served, based on calculations, the whole sentence that they were sentenced to, plus any other that was added because of behavior or taken away because of behavior or whatever.
Right.
They are going to be released. They have served all the time that we can legally assign them to or sentence them to. They're okay. Going home or going someplace out in society.
Right.
What this reformation bill, if you want to call it that, did was it takes those same individuals And rather than lose complete control of them when their EOS expires, which is legally they're done, we give them unlocked the gate, let them loose, and said, go on, okay?
Yeah.
What we've done with this bill is we have now taken it so that about a year before they reach that EOS, we give them some opportunity so that we can monitor them. You want to go out, let's get you trained up and ready to go out. Let's put this monitoring device on you so we can track you. Let's see where you're going to live. Let's make sure you got a job. Let's make sure you're going to do this so that we can get them eased into society without having them to steal their first meal, if that makes sense.
No, it makes absolute sense. I guess my next question on that would be, is there going to be funding to provide, you know, the bureaucratic support to make those kinds of goals possible?
We've already set aside $800,000 for the monitors, yes.
Okay. All right. Last question on prison. There was an issue.
Now, back up. I need to address one more issue on this, okay?
Go ahead, yeah.
While it is true that's the single bill that we passed in this special session, don't forget that the legislature passed three additional bills last spring dealing with reformation.
Okay.
Prior to that, we passed reformation bills every single session. And 2015 is when we made the big change that was there, dealing with sentencing reform, redefinitions of crimes, and those type things.
Okay.
So the harping that we're having about how we have gone off the reservation, if you will, probably a poor choice of words here, but
that's okay.
That we've gone into hinterlands on the reformation is just not accurate. We've done this thoughtfully. We've done it over a course of years and time frames for the funding so that we can acclimate matters correctly.
Right.
We've done all those things, I think, properly. We got still more to go, but most of it is a matter of implementation, not of passing.
Okay. Let me just ask you this. This question about the use of the COVID money, CARES Act money, that seems to have, you know, people like Nadler are trying to kill it, but I think there's an interpretation that this is pretty much free money, the second batch of it. Is that pretty much your understanding, that you can use this money without having the feds take it out from under you?
It is my understanding and belief that what we have done is perfectly legal, perfectly appropriate, and done in the correct and proper manner.
Okay.
That has follows the guidelines, that is following every clear delineation for the use of these funds.
Okay. Now, you know where I'm going with this, because $2.1 billion supposedly was given to Alabama, and you're only using, I think, $400 million. So the next question is, if we have this pile of money out there, can you use it for the I-10 bridge project?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay.
We've already started. That has been a concern that we've looked at.
Right.
But I don't believe that's going to get there.
Okay. I don't have time to get into the details of it, but I think it's worth pursuing, because as I read the standards that you could use this money for, it seems like it fell into that broad category. But let's kind of just put that on hold for right now, Greg. I do think we can come back to it at a later point at a show.
Let me say this about that, if I might.
Okay.
The money on the table, sitting in the bank, public money that's with government, everybody sees it, everybody wants it, and everybody's plan is the correct one and the right one. It's just that we have 178 plans. But we don't have that much money to spend.
I hear you. Okay. What we have to do is just make that I-10 project, bumped up to, put it into the status of the next. It's going to be number two on the hit parade. I guess that's where we have to go with that.
Even if that were, I'll put it even more direct. Even if we were to have the opportunity, the legal opportunity, use part of that money for roads and bridges, politically would be extremely difficult to use it for our bridge.
Okay. Yeah, that's another bridge that we have to cross, that's for sure. All right, let's shift to the redistricting one, okay? Now, I know that have you gotten any idea when this redistricting session is supposed to start? I've heard different things, but you and I had a conversation, and it sounded like this thing was really going to kick off pretty soon thereafter, but now I'm hearing the end of October. So what's your thought on that?
Right now, as of this morning, the time frame that I think we're on is October 25th, I think it is.
Okay.
Sometime the fourth week of this month.
Okay. Now, before I get into the details of redistricting and the questions that are out there, I know that I've asked you before about this HB 31, which is a bill that Horton has put up that basically protects individuals from being forced to get a shot of the jab for employment. But my question has been, is it, and I knew that for the prison bill, you couldn't ask them to do anything with it, but do you think it's possible to go to the governor and ask her to get this into this next session for redistricting?
I'm sure the governor has already been approached along that line. I know that this is a consideration that she has and a concern that she has. As for the bill itself, it's already in the system. It already has a number. It's going to be going through the process. As far as Alabama's concerned, I think it has a high probability of that or its first cousin or sister or whatever.
Right.
Probably get passed.
Okay. I'm assuming it's going to pass too, but I think the question is it going to pass in January, or can we get it in October, since we've had these issues about people losing their jobs over this jab issue? So that's the issue for me, I guess.
Is it going to be brought forward in the special session, and the governor going to name it? I don't think the governor has the legislative support to put that in the call.
Okay, so what do we have to do then to get the legislative support? I mean, I know you're in favor of it, and I'm sure several others, all these people who pre-filed the bill. Why wouldn't they want to go ahead and ask the governor to do that?
Well, it's not a matter of people asking the governor. The governor's been asked that, okay? I can tell you that.
Okay.
All right, the question is, though, I've got folks that's telling her not to.
Okay.
Now, I don't know what those numbers are, nor who those folks are necessarily, but I can tell you, as far as the Senate is concerned, Jim McClendon does not want a single distraction from his bill. The information I've gotten, again, just this morning, is that he plans on getting four bills passed through the House and Senate dealing with reapportionment, redistricting, in 5 days. I don't think that would occur if we had other bills brought in.
Okay.
At least that's his thinking.
Okay. So, I mean, I guess right now we're running ads down here to have people call Governor Ivey and include this bill. So what else can we do besides the calls and things like that? I mean, is it worth the possibility of you going to see the governor and say, look, I know McClendon, but we can walk and talk and chew gum at the same time. We can do both and not necessarily be restricted to 5 days. Is there a magic number about 5 days?
Only because that's the minimum number needed to pass a bill. Okay. The other aspect is the magic number is into November, between elections and other things that's coming about.
Right.
Magic number is just the shortest time that you're delayed from all those other activities.
Right. So in theory, McClendon could get his stuff done in 5 days, and then on the sixth day, that Saturday or whatever, you could do the HB 31. I mean, at least technically, it could be possible, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's always feasible and possible. We had discussed with the prison bill that we would go into Saturday or even Sunday if we did not make it on the Friday time frame.
Okay. All right. So let's just I'm kind of stuck on this in part because I'm running out of time, but I'm also, you know, trying to do as much as we can to get the governor's attention on this. So I guess I'm going to just have to ask you to call her and see if she would buy into getting this done, you know, and put her on the spot. I mean, look, Greg, she's got a lot of problems with the conservative base. I know she doesn't care too much about that right now, but down this road after January 28th, I think that there's, you know, going to be a lot more heartburn about her, not only if she doesn't do something about HB 31, but all the other things she's got out there that we don't particularly care for, Amendment 1 and all the rest of that stuff. So I don't know. Maybe you could sell yourself to her as, you know, Governor, I'm trying to help you get reelected, and here's something you could do. You know, not that I'm going to vote for her now, Greg, but nevertheless.
Now, how am I going to be able to persuade her?
You don't have to say anything about me.
She
doesn't know me from anybody. So, it be that as it may. All right, let's get into the redistricting thing real quick here, okay? And I'm going to focus on just two things: Baldwin County and this the minority majority district that's carved out for Congress. So let's just talk about Baldwin County. Where do you think this is going? I mean, I understand that we've gotten a lot more people here. How is that going to affect you and Chris Elliott's district? And I know Matt Simpson, who's got a split district as a House member, he's advocating for him just to have his district only in the Daphne area, I guess is what it boils down to. So what does the big picture look like for Baldwin County in terms of this redistricting?
I'm unsure. It's unclear to me how this is going to fall out yet.
Yeah.
It is. I know this because I've seen everybody's hands and footprints and fingerprints and everything all over all these maps. It's amazing that you can see the lines with so many prints all over them.
Yeah.
I don't know that yet. And there's arguments always with both sides. I mean, you know, Baldwin County could have could take Matt in and take even 64 and make it a whole all Baldwin County matter. But the question would become, what gain is that for Baldwin County? It doesn't increase the number that's there. It doesn't increase the delegation size. It doesn't increase the votes.
Yeah.
So that there's a pridefulness there, for lack of a better term, I guess, that comes into play, that we want, you know, Baldwin County. All that's fine and great, but we've also got to find a way that we can increase our influence, and that means we've got to increase our votes in some way. And we have the numbers as far as people. Now we've got to get the representatives fixed up here, and we're kind of in a crunch, because we can't take Pensacola, and I already run from Crestview to Mississippi. So, you know, there's the only way we move very often is north and south in that way.
Yeah,
that's a slow growth methodology, and in particular with the minorities that's involved and how that's going. We've already got one lawsuit filed in this matter already, from what I understand.
Yeah.
So it's complicated. It's not just what we're going to do. It's more along the line of what we're trying to guess the courts will do.
Okay.
And that's even further complicated.
Well, I guess we're just going to have to stand by and watch this. Is there anything that we can do to help you? This is not a question. There's no answer because I'm running out of time. But I will stay in touch with you to make sure that if we need to have a meeting or anything like that and kind of give people's thoughts on this, we will do that down the road, okay?
Sure, but now I will say this. You know, with Chris Pringle in charge in the House, and these things are all being discussed. they are being openly discussed, and well, I say openly, they're being within the realms of those folks that are involved. Everybody's involved. Everybody's voice is being heard on this.
Right.
And there is no easy answer, but I think we're going to get there. I think we're going to make this work. It may not. It may be one of those that no one likes, but we're going to eat it anyway. You
know? Okay. Well, Senator Al Britton, thank you so much for coming on today, sharing your thoughts, and we wish you well in all you're doing. Take care.
Thank you for your patience with me.
Okay.
Thank you,
sir. Be good.
Sir.
See you later. Bye-bye. Well, folks, another quick half hour. Notice that this did go over. Oh, Lori, I am indebted to you.
Six minutes. Deeply.
I'll have to get Kevin to send a little extra check here. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, this wraps this up for another week. Today is Columbus Day. Don't forget that. Of course, everybody wants to forget Columbus Day because the radical historians painted him in such a bad fashion. But nevertheless, have a happy Columbus Day, and we will see you next, or you'll hear from me next Monday. Y'all take care.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Lou. You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campomenosi. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne on Highway 98 and in Malbus on 181 with a state-of-the-art car wash. You can hear this program later in its entirety at WABF1480.com.